Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Hello everyone, this is Richard Martin here with Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Let me first start by telling you about something that my wife and I did last night, which I have never done before, and I don't think my wife has either. We went to the meetup of one of the presidential candidates while the candidates themselves were engaged in a national debate, which was on TV, and the debate was actually about 20 minutes from where we live in Boca Raton, so we thought we'd give it the old college try. We arrived at the restaurant where the supporters of Ron Paul were gathered with all their signs and merrymaking. Interestingly enough, they were mostly young people, I would say less than 30 years old, which is apparently where Ron Paul himself says he gets most of his support. It was an interesting environment. We arrived about 3 hours before the actual debate itself, so there were various speakers who were speaking. And of course, Ron Paul's interest is very much economic, which is why I'm speaking to you about it right now, rather than for other social issues. The economic input is where we concentrate on. As supporters, I guess, what was of interest to me particularly was when I was talking to people to find that really nobody knew why they were supporting Ron Paul. I spoke to one man, he must have been about mid-20s, we got into talking, and he told me that he was an economics major. And I said to him, well, why are you supporting Ron Paul? He said, well, he just seems to me to offer some refreshing change to the status quo. And I said, what particular area of his thinking is it which gets you the most? And he said, oh, just in general. I like his economic ideas. And I said, which ideas are you referring to? He said, well, it's hard to put it into words. He just seems to have a refreshing new approach. And I discovered that here was a fairly well-educated person with very little idea of what it was that he was supporting about Ron Paul. So I spent about 10 minutes explaining some of the features of his economic platform, most notably the question of the IRS and the end of the Federal Reserve, and I explained in quite a lot of detail about this. And the guy looked at me and he said, "You know something? It's interesting because with all of my training in economics, I find it possible to follow you, but I shouldn't think there's one person here in this group that could have understood a lot of what you said." And I really thought about it, and I'm thinking, you know, all of these people who were supporting Ron Paul, they're supporting him for a feeling that they have. The man clearly emanates a sensation of something good that's workable, as opposed to the other horrendous creatures on that stage last night who really have nothing to add, nothing of any originality or dynamism to add at all. And of course, in the usual way, Ron Paul was ignored. He didn't get to speak at all for the first 20 minutes. It was an insult, of course. I mean, one might say, well, these television stations, or they have the right to have whoever they want on them and to interrogate whoever they wish. But, you know, in other countries, when these candidates come up for election, they have a mandated time, equal time schedule on television and on the radio. And so I accept that in this country the candidates don't have that, but I do think that, you know, the stations should take their responsibilities seriously and give these people equal time. Because after all, it's not for the stations to decide who they think should be president and therefore who should receive more time. It is really a function of a democratic, so-called democratic process that should be working in favor of all of the candidates, but certainly not in Ron Paul's favor. So anyway, that was interesting. He came to us after the debate and spoke for 15 minutes to all of the company gathered around. I got to shake his hand, which was nice. Today, this morning, I was very alarmed to see that he has just announced his economic advisor in the form of a man called Don Laskin, who, quite frankly, is incompetent in the extreme. I mean, here's a man who lost 100% of the investors' money in the dot-com crash of the early decade, and he left the street.com in disgrace. He is currently very bullish on the economy. He thinks the economy is doing fine, thank you, and lower interest rates will do the trick and everything. It's hard for me to imagine that Ron Paul selected this man knowing all these things about him. I'm very concerned for him. If only I had known 24 hours earlier what I know today, I would have said something to him when I saw him last night, but unfortunately such was not to be the case. But so there we have it, you know. Very sad for Ron Paul. He consistently does well in the straw polls, but when it comes to these primary elections, he lags sadly behind, but not for want of trying, I must say. And it does seem that he will stick it out till the end. He has the money to do it, so, you know, I for one am hoping that he'll do well. Okay. Again, my name is Richard Martin, and it's Richard Martin's Wake Up Call that you are currently listening to, coming to you from Miami, Florida, a very overcast Miami, Florida, and through, obviously, the studio of Progressive Radio Network in New York City. My phone number, if you should wish to speak to me in private, is 305-357-5575. My email address, if you would like to email me, is rmartin@gscorporation.com. Now, please remember, the corporation word has to be written out in full. The G stands for global, the S stands for strategic. It's Global Strategic Investments, where I work. Please, again, remember to write out the address in lower case. Again, I will repeat the address. It is rmartin@gscorporation.com. All right. Well, today, ladies and gentlemen, we must have some education. We have to learn something, and I intend to try to teach it. Doesn't happen every session, but today I have decided that I must give you the skinny on these famous Fed funds rates, which keep getting reset by the Federal Reserve. I want you to know what they are, and I want you to know what they represent, and how they fit into the general scheme of things, because they are considered to be so important. They are really not that important, but since the world of finance believes them to be important, it behooves you to know what they are and how they come to be. So just bear with me for a few minutes. We will discuss this, and hopefully I will get some questions if anybody feels they want to know more, or if not, questions about other unrelated matters. Again, the toll-free number is 888-873-4643. So if there are any questions, hold them off for about 5 or 10 minutes while I talk about the Federal Reserve, and then feel free to call. And if I am, by the way, engaged in some kind of a subject which doesn't lend itself to being broken up, please be patient. Hang on. Our engineer will put you through as soon as I have a convenient break, which I do from time to time. And, of course, I am informed through the computer that you're on the line. So I am aware that you're there. Just hold it, and we will come to you in the fullness of time. All right. So, first of all, obviously, and I've mentioned this many times, in my opinion, and by the way, the opinion of more and more people right now, Alan Greenspan was mostly to blame for the debacle in which we find ourselves today. And that was as a consequence of the rate cuts put into place in 2001 after 9/11 in an attempt to stave off a recession. So really what happened was that too cheap money caused the inflation of an asset bubble in a place that it had never been in any time at the, in the American experience, i.e. residential real estate. Now, that effect, that residential real estate bubble, is real. It did happen, and those who said, well, this was just a natural course of prices rising, are and were mistaken. There was an out-of-control bubble in real estate prices, and those who profited from it know that full well. That we know. What isn't so easy to define is the cause. Not quite so simple. See, one of the things that you have to realize about the Federal Reserve, which, as I just said, was overwhelmingly responsible for this bubble, is that they actually don't set interest rates, long or short, at all, in fact. The interest rates that you hear, the interest rate was put down by the Federal Reserve. They didn't actually put down any price or any rate. You know, the official language is always that the Fed sets the so-called Fed funds target rate. But you need to understand that nobody can actually borrow at a so-called target rate. So what does the Fed actually do? Well, the target is indeed a lending rate, their so-called intended overnight lending rate, between the banks. They defend this target by either injecting liquidity, i.e. cash, into the banking system, or withdrawing it from the banking system. Now, to inject cash, they temporarily take in various debt securities, mostly treasury securities, but others as well, from banks, and issue them cash, much like you'd pawn a Rolex, say, or a diamond ring, or a handgun. Now, these, what they call repos, have a relatively short term, which lasts typically from 1 to 30 days. And when they expire, you, as the bank, are required to give the Fed back the cash with, of course, interest. These TOMOs, or temporary open market operations, are conducted daily in the normal course of operation of the banking system. If the actual trading rate of overnight money between banks is too low, the Fed will either refuse to roll over some of the expiring TOMOs, thereby reducing the amount of sloshing or free cash in the system, or, if necessary, will actually do a reverse TOMO, effectively putting some of its treasuries that it holds itself out into the marketplace. Now, when the manipulations of this sort become overly burdensome to maintain the target rate, because the demand for overnight money has either fallen or risen too strongly to be defended, the target itself is changed. And that's it. That's really it. That's what happens when the Fed raises or lowers the Fed funds rate. Okay? Now, there's a second sort of operation called a POMO, with a P, or permanent open market operation. But these are far more rare. They are literally outright purchases, or sales if a reverse, of these securities. Typically, the Fed will do a handful of these per year to cover the increase in the actual demand for hard currency that accrues in the system over a year. These are very small, usually in the neighborhood of $10 or $20 billion in total in a given year, and really are printing of money, in the sense that we all come to think of it, in that the Treasury is the source of the T-bills, and when they are permanently taken off the market and exchanged for dollars, those dollars are effectively printed. The Fed didn't do the printing. The Treasury did. The Fed was merely the conduit. Okay, now let's be absolutely clear here. Liquidity, so-called, is not printing money. It isn't inflationary. In addition, the actual monetary inflation conducted by injections of real hard cash into the system has been minuscule all through 2007, and by the way, prior years as well. Let's apply that to a typical investor situation, and it should become clear. Let's say that you have some diamonds, a Rolex, and a couple of handguns. Let's also say that you have a job, and that job pays you $5,000 a month after taxes. You basically spend all of this having only a few hundred dollars in the bank in cash. After all, you're a good little consumer, right? Now, let us assume that your car has no collision or comprehensive insurance. That is, you maintain only the legally required liability insurance. Okay? So late one night while you're sleeping, Joe Thug shows up and steals your car. You wake up in the morning and find that your car is gone. This is, of course, a disaster. You need to get to work or you will soon not have that $5,000 a month in income. Well, now you have a problem, don't you? You could go to the bank, but the bank is likely to look askance at your request for a loan. After all, you don't have a house, and they're not at all interested in your Rolex. So you go down the street to the local pawn shop. Here you find liquidity. You execute the equivalent of a personal TOMO with the pawn shop owner. He gives you cash, and you give him your Rolex, your diamonds, and all but one of your handguns. You need the last one in case Joe Thug shows up again. Note that once you walk out of the pawn shop, you are actually in a worse financial situation than you were before. Yes, you're liquid, but you now have an interest payment monkey on your back to go along with the cash. Okay, when the Fed injects liquidity, they haven't created money. In fact, they have made the bank's balance sheets more encumbered because the interest has to be paid too. But of course, just like the bank, you use that $2,000 to buy yourself a car. This allows you to go to work and keep your job. A month passes, you tighten your belt, and the TOMO matures. You pay the pawn shop owner back with interest and retrieve your Rolex, guns, and diamonds. Okay, when you hear that the Fed has injected liquidity into the system, this is what has happened. Further, what is almost always not reported in the media is that amount of maturing tomos on the same day or those bordering the action. So you will hear reported that the Fed, or European Central Bank, ECB, has injected a record amount of liquidity into the system, as if this is some bullish thing. But what they fail to mention is that the same, or even more in many cases, tomos, have matured on the same day, making the net injection zero. Just remember, guys, liquidity isn't hard cash. It's a loan. It carries interest, and it has to be paid back on a short-term basis. All right, so hopefully we've dispensed with this folly that the Fed can save us. In fact, they cannot. They want people to believe they can, however, because from that belief derives literally all of their power. Should people actually come to understand the above, the fact that liquidity is just really a loan, much like a pawn shop gives you, and that the Fed is powerless to impact what is going on in this fashion in the end, as loans always have to be paid back, they would lose the only real weapon they have, the power of the mouth. You've seen it. Some Fed governor speaks and the market moves, often dramatically. The public and investors believe that the Fed is omnipotent, and that results in the market moving when they talk. The power is, in fact, illusory, just as was the Wizard of Oz. Understand this, and you're ahead of 99% of all investors on Wall Street, including so-called professionals. Now, I've noticed that the archives seem to have been updated right up until my last broadcast on Tuesday. So if you want to listen to that explanation again, it might be worthwhile doing so because it's really very important. And it will save you a lot of grief when you hear all these pundits telling you how much money is being poured into the system and how they're goosing the money supply and how everything is getting more expensive because of inflation, etc., etc. All, I'm afraid, fairyland talk. Okay. Let me give you my toll-free number once again for those of you who'd like to call in. It is 888-873-4643. All right. Now, just a little bit more about, the printing of money. One of the great economists of our time, who's of course died now, is Murray Rothbard, and he wrote a book called The Great Depression. And I would like to read you a few excerpts from that book. The first one is from page 11, and this is what he has to say. He says, "Now, what happens when banks print new money, whether as banknotes or bank deposits, and lend it to business? The new money pours forth on the loan market and lowers the loan rate of interest. It looks as if the supply of saved funds for investment has increased, for the effect is the same. The supply of funds for investment apparently increases and the interest rate is lowered. Businessmen, in short, are misled by the bank inflation into believing that the supply of saved funds is greater than it really is. Now, when saved funds increase, businessmen invest in longer processes of production, i.e. the capital structure is lengthened, especially in the higher orders most remote from the consumer. Businessmen take their newly acquired funds and bid up the prices of capital and other producers' goods, and this stimulates a shift of investment from the lower, near the consumer, to the higher orders of production, furthest from the consumer, from consumer goods to capital goods industries." Well, that's actually a fascinating statement. It's absolutely fascinating. That bank credit actually influences the investor to make mistakes by causing them to mistake borrowed funds for saved funds. It is even so now, and Rothbard and the Austrians all contend that this is where government policy creates depressions by doing what our government is actually doing right now, continuing to support the inflation and the perception that capital is available at such low risk rates. The result of this is low consumer prices and high capital goods prices, which he describes as not only machinery, but mines and commodities. Where we might be mistaken in this market is that we intermingle capital or production prices with what we believe to be consumer prices. Thus, we are witnessing a worldwide situation where business is actually spending and investing itself out of business. Another short excerpt here from page 15 of America's Great Depression. Another common secondary feature of depressions is an increase in the demand for money. This scramble for liquidity is the result of several factors. One, people expect falling prices due to the depression and deflation, and will therefore hold more money and spend less on goods, awaiting the price fall. Two, borrowers will try to pay off their debts, now being called by banks and by business creditors, by liquidating other assets in exchange for money. Three, the rash of business losses and bankruptcies makes businessmen cautious about investing until the liquidation process is over. All right. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to know that from now on, I will be talking as if we were actually in a depression. We're not there yet, exactly in terms of the statistics. But, of course, some are in terms of those who have lost their houses and don't have anywhere to live. They most certainly are living in a depression, and that includes a lot of people in the state of Michigan, by the way. I do believe that by the summer, the statistics will show a very, very severe recession, which many people will start to call a depression. I actually called for the beginning of it in February, at the end of February last year, when we had that huge down move in the Chinese market. Some of you may remember that. This is a slow process. It's not something which just morphs into being from one day to the next. So anyway, the last excerpt I want to read you from this book is a footnote from that same page that I was reading, page 15. And this is what it says. It says, banks are inherently bankrupt because they issue far more warehouse receipts to cash, nowadays in the form of deposits redeemable in cash on demand, than they have cash available. Hence, they are always vulnerable to bank runs. These runs are not like any other business failures because they simply consist of depositors claiming their own rightful property, which the banks do not have. Inherent bankruptcy, then, is an essential feature of any fractional reserve banking system. As Frank Graham stated, the attempt of the banks to realize the inconsistent aims of lending cash or merely multiplied claims to cash and still to represent that cash is available on demand is even more preposterous than eating one's cake and counting on it for future consumption. The alleged convertibility is a delusion dependent upon the rights not being unduly exercised. Frankly, it's got to the point that to pay to the order or pay on demand means nothing in banking. Keeping the books straight means very little on their part and everything on our part. They're already on the hook for 10 times as much as they can produce on demand or at any point, and now they need a bailout. It's no wonder this stuff isn't taught in college in most places. Okay, let's look at the mail. We have, and I'm just checking this now, we have two emails. One comes from a gentleman named Mark. And he says, and I read, do you think that the general investor will flee the stock market for the bonds, lemming style? Would it be beneficial to invest in bonds now to profit on that surge, leaving before CDs and swaps cause bonds to crash? Mark, the answer would be no. I mean, I don't really agree with the idea of jumping in and out of markets and just hoping to sort of speculate on the moves. As I've said several times on this show, the best thing you can do right now is to buy treasury bills, which have very short maturities, and await an entry into the bond market in several weeks' time. In fact, we've started to see quite a sickening fall in the price of bonds over the last few days. So this is exactly what I had predicted would happen, and I think this has further to go. So I certainly wouldn't buy bonds right now, but I do think that it will be beneficial to invest in bonds, but not because you're going to jump out, you know, a short while later. This will be a long-term investment. And, of course, I do mean treasury bonds. Okay, thank you, Mark, for the question. Here's a question from Walt. And Walt says, Hi, Richard. Do you think the recent action of the Fed and the Bush stimulus plan will forestall the deflationary economy you expect, or will these actions only serve to create the deflationary conditions quicker? My feeling is that these actions will only make things worse. Thanks for your continued excellent commentary on the economy. Thanks, Walt. Okay, Walt, well, I agree with you. I think these actions will make things worse because it's really a case of providing more of the drug that caused the addiction in the first place, namely money, and feeding that addiction and expecting it to go away. This is not the right way to do things. The idea of giving away to each person $600 or $800 is frankly meaningless. You know, what are they going to do with it? They're going to run down to Walmart and buy some more Chinese goods, and the money then just gets paid into Chinese bank accounts. Just doesn't seem very logical to me, but none of the people in the government seem to me to have much of a fine appreciation of economics to start with. So it's hardly surprising that, you know, they resort to these rather facile and sort of obvious tricks, which are obviously wrong. I do believe that these actions will make things worse, yes. I don't know that they will create the deflationary conditions quicker, as you say, Walt. I believe they will accelerate the decline of the economy and the markets quicker. Yes, sure. But that particular move itself is not deflationary per se. So I certainly don't think that the stimulus plan will forestall the deflationary economy. I think it will. It will simply bring on people's penury quicker. People will simply find themselves more in debt than they were before the stimulus plan was announced. But of course, you have to understand that these plans are really designed to fulfill political purposes rather than economic ones. So it's really hardly surprising that happens. Sad though that may be, sad though it actually is. Okay, once more, my 800, or rather my toll-free number, which is 888-873-4643. Once more, 888-873-4643. I thought it might be rather fun to compare one element of the economic situation between the various different presidential candidates, just to see what they have to say and to see how they treat this particular situation when asked about it. And this information comes from an article I read in MarketWatch, and it's to do with the energy policy. And, of course, all the proposals are either ambitious or vague or both. Obama, for example, speaking about the energy policies he would support as president, said, "I will set big goals for this country as president, some so large that the technology to reach them doesn't yet exist." Wow. What's he going to do? Invent a perpetual motion device? Or is this merely a poor Kennedy imitation? You know, at least Kennedy had a goal people could understand, which was to get to the moon. Well, Clinton said during the New Hampshire debate in December that the next president needs to make sure that the next energy policy is good for, quote, our security and good for the fight against global warming. Interesting, right? So Clinton would try to collect money from oil companies to pay for investments in new alternative energy sources and increase car fuel efficiency. Well, fair enough, but this amounts to taxing the producers and subsidizing the dreamers, frankly. Perhaps she wants to fund Obama's mission to build technology that doesn't yet exist. How about John Edwards? Well, he's focused his position on energy policy on corporate profits and consistently refers to energy companies as entrenched lobbying interests that he would take on if elected president. Today's report that the price of oil has reached $100 a barrel, well, that's a report that came from a few days ago, is just another example of how corporate greed is squeezing the middle class. Those are his words, by the way. It's time for us to rise up and take on the corporate greed. Well, thank you very much for that, John. But why is it the profits are fine everywhere but energy? Why not tax greedy politicians? Well, Republicans are not lost on big promises themselves with little specifics. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney says he will wean America off oil by using more biofuels and nuclear power, though biofuels are a small part of the domestic fuel supply and a nuclear power plant hasn't been built in decades. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee says he will develop a plan to end America's energy addiction in 8 years through greater reliance on nuclear, wind, solar, hydrogen, clean coal, biodiesel, and biomass. At the same time, Huckabee says the free market will sort out what makes the most sense economically, obviously leaving voters to figure out how the president and the free market will work out the particulars. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani wants a little bit more of everything in the energy basket. A little more production of biofuels, coal, nuclear power, solar power, wind power, hydropower, and hybrid vehicles. The mayor supports government help for the businesses developing new technologies, but adds he, quote, doesn't necessarily mean larger subsidies. Okay, so we're going to offer government help that does cost anything? Good idea. Paradoxically, the way to accomplish that is to get out of the way by offering no help. Well, former Senator Fred Thompson, who is now no more, thinks that the U.S. can become more energy independent, but says politicians need to level with the public. I quote, we're not going to be energy independent in a few years. And that was during his January 6th Republican debate. Well, that proposal clearly has no substance, but at least it's honest. Well, now we come to Ron Paul, who's the only candidate, as usual, who has a plan worth hearing about. Of course, he was left out of the Market Watch article, interestingly enough, so we have to cull this information from different sources. And here's his proposal. 1, get out of Iraq. 2, stop wasting energy transporting troops all over the world. 3, stop wasting energy flying needless missions all over the world. 4, stop this insane saber-rattling with Iran. Instead, sit down at the table and discuss things with them. 5, legalize hemp for biofuel and fiber production. 6, eliminate subsidies on grains. 7, eliminate subsidies for ethanol production. 8, eliminate tariffs on ethanol imports. 9, stop flooding the world with dollars. 10, let the free market solve the problem, no matter what fashion it takes or how long it takes. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, the energy policy, courtesy of the next president. Okay, Harry, I apologize, you've been waiting a long time online. I hope you're still there from New York. Can we hear from you, please? Harry? Harry, are you there? Nope, no Harry. All right. Well, here's a couple of what I thought were rather fun comparisons with past examples of difficult situations, and they come from ancient history, so I thought it might be fun to bring you in on this. One is called Anagnorisis, and I'll explain what that is. The Fed's 0.75% cut is a late step towards official recognition of the serious nature of the current situation. U.S. monetary and fiscal authorities are desperately scrambling to save Comatose Achilles. If Greek mythology is any guide, die he will in the end. What else do musty archives teach us about the current economic situation? According to Aristotle, a good tragedy's plot contains three elements. First, peripeteia, i.e. the reversal or the turning point. The reversal usually occurs contrary to the audience's expectations, nonetheless being an inevitable outcome of the preceding actions. After the reversal follows anagnorisis, i.e. the recognition by the tragic hero of some truth or a change from ignorance to knowledge, according to Aristotle's Poetics. After recognition follows pathos, i.e. suffering, pity, and fear. Well, peripeteia happened last year. It is apparent in the reversal of many important financial time series. As in any good tragedy, the reversal was certainly unexpected at the time, although it is obvious by hindsight that something had to give. We are now in the midst of anagnorisis, with some people, Fed Funds futures traders, for example, being at a further stage of recognition than others, maybe central bankers, especially those from the ECB, for example. It is an open issue whether monetary and fiscal stimuli can postpone pathos, but if life is indeed a stage, pathos will follow in the end. Interesting. Well, going back to Achilles, who must die, you will remember that Achilles, the hero of the Trojan War and a central character of Homer's Iliad, was killed by a poison arrow discharged at him by Paris and guided by Apollo to his heel. Achilles had previously offended Apollo by his hubristic killing of Troilus inside Apollo's temple. Achilles' death was divine retribution, inevitable, predicted by his mother Thetis and by Hector with his dying breath. So what does Greek mythology have to do with today's economic situation? According to Ben Bernanke and many quantitatively skilled economists, probably nothing. According to the Austrian school of economics, however, quite a lot. In the realm of Austrian economics, a boom is always followed by a bust, as surely as Achilles' slaying of Troilus followed by Achilles' death, as his hubris followed by catharsis, pride by a fall, and crime by punishment. This sequence is an irrefutable law of nature which also applies to an economy. Excessive credit creation is like hubris, a trespass against natural order, and is destined to end in catharsis, i.e., in an economic bust. Achilles should already have died in the second half of the 1990s. However, Alan Greenspan dodged the first arrow to Achilles' heel by excessive credit creation and by nurturing a stock market bubble. The second arrow to Achilles' heel was shot in 2001. It was again deflected by a further increase in credit and another bubble, this time in housing. The third arrow was shot last year. Achilles' death from the third arrow would be cruel, as Apollo is foaming by now because of mortal interference in divine destiny. However, Achilles' death now might still be child's play compared to the violent bloodbath that would follow if Achilles is saved a third time and the irate Apollo has to launch a fourth arrow. Apollo's increasing wrath does not prevent U.S. monetary and fiscal authorities to try to save Achilles once more from his destiny. If Greek mythology is any guide, though, their efforts are in vain. Achilles must die. Saving Achilles from this arrow only delays fate and ensures that his eventual death will be all the more gruesome. How nice. Let us alleviate the proceedings somewhat by hearing from Trish. Trish has written me an email in which she says, Richard, I heard that the government is borrowing the money from China or printing the money out of thin air to give the people that tax rebate check. Is that true? Won't this make the problem that much worse? Excellent question, Trish. By the way, Trish is referring to the recent decision to grant a tax rebate to the general populace in the hopes that it will sort of stimulate spending and thereby stimulate economic growth and things will go back to normal. I mean, clearly that is it's nothing. It's not even a carrot. It's just it's a false sense of security. It will not achieve anything at all. I mean, take it from me. There's nothing there to bite on. The government is indeed borrowing money from China because what happens is that the Chinese put money into treasury bonds, and of course that represents a loan which has to be paid back with interest by the American government direct to the Chinese accounts. Printing the money out of thin air, well, of course, I talked about that just now, Trish. The concept that the Fed is just printing money sounds fanciful, but it really doesn't happen in real life, in the way supposed. The tax rebate check, Trish, simply comes by reducing the amount of money that is available for the services that the government provides in other areas. That will be done. We don't know how that will be done. We do know, for example, that in California, where they have had a budget deficit, 40% greater than they expected, Governor Schwarzenegger just basically mandated an across-the-board 10% cut in expenses of one sort or another, which is basically a cop-out because there is so much in the California budget which is completely useless, a complete waste of time, programs which have absolutely no interest, which cost a huge amount of money, which he could simply cut out. But to do so, of course, means cutting out the votes as well. So rather than risk that, he takes a step which is much more popular, but, of course, much less well-advised. Doubtless the federal government will do the same kind of thing. It's not really easy to tell what they will do. One of the things that, of course, you all have to understand is that when there is less money coming in to the system, then obviously there's less money for all forms of payment that have to be made, including the interest of the Chinese. But that interest has to be paid. And since the United States is indeed a AAA-rated country, highest rating of all, the chances are very high that they will pay out that interest, and it will be a priority among them for that purpose. But it will be tough. And the problem will get much worse, Trish, but not really because of printing of money, but simply because of the lack of the ability and willingness of the consumer to spend. And that's really what's behind everything. And that's the crux of what makes an economy turn, is the willingness of its people to spend money and the ability of its people to spend money, neither of which they have. Well, we have a few more minutes. I just wanted to conclude with a rather grim assessment of the United Kingdom, where I come from, which is now considered by one of its most prestigious newspapers, the Daily Telegraph, to be technically bankrupt, despite 15 years of growth. It is quite shocking, but the degree of borrowing and lending and futile loans that are out there actually surpasses that of the United States, if such a thing were possible. Certainly nothing that I would have imagined while I lived there all of 25 years ago. The country must have changed out of all proportion to anything I knew, because debt was a very dirty word when I left the United Kingdom. But there are now, in fact, more people in employment in the UK than at any time in history. And that says something rather remarkable, as a matter of fact. Whilst we all whine away about the state of this and the condition of that, quietly the general population is just getting on and doing its hardest to earn a crust. Of course, these numbers are slightly distorted by the huge influx of hard-working Eastern Continentals who actually seem to be the ones getting the jobs. You know, in times of plenty, that's especially when we have so many people contributing to the exchequer, you would expect the government coffers to be overflowing with abundance. Yet after, apparently, 15 years of steady growth, the country is effectively bankrupt, even with some of the highest taxes in the developed world, with the biggest budget deficit ever recorded. And this doesn't even include all the hidden costs and the massive public sector pensions liability. You know, probably heard that one before too. Tax income has been lower than expected in recent months, and with the possible drawdown, all we can expect is that those nice, work-loving Eastern Continentals will start to drift back to the homeland if jobs dry up, which is a rather fanciful thought, if you ask me, but I agree with the writer that it's about the only thing that they can hope for. The state of the country's bank balance has been here before in the time of the sainted Maggie, but at that point, we were in a full-blown recession and the government was spending to get us out of it. If the economy does slow now, we can expect some very serious belt tightening this time round. The prudent ex-chancellor may yet regret not calling an election, you know, and therefore possibly leaving the whole mess to that nice but dim chap, Mr. Cameron, who is, by the way, the leader of the Conservative Opposition Party. Forgive me for being cynical, but politicians of whatever hue seem to consider being in power as a sign of success rather than actually doing a good job. I cannot remember a difficult or unpopular policy being implemented in the last 10 years. Well, that seems to be the nature of things today, ladies and gentlemen. It's seems to be worldwide. It doesn't confine itself to the United Kingdom or the United States. The rest of Europe is in very serious trouble right now with its social policies and social programs, which they can't possibly afford. The euro is also in trouble. The euro, in my opinion, is a currency which is very likely to implode in the next 5 years. There are countries in Europe which now want to go back to their original currencies. The Germans want to go back to the Deutschmark, the Italians want to go back to the lira, and the French want to go back to their franc. And there's a vote, I believe, coming up in Italy shortly. It's like a vote of confidence in the government, namely whether the Italians will demand their currency back. I always wondered, you know, how they thought that they would unite such disparate economies originally with the euro. If you can imagine a NAFTA gone completely haywire, that is the European community for you. It's a group of countries with totally disparate economies trying to make themselves into a united whole where the streams of workers are pouring from one country to another in search of work, as often as not speaking the language of the new country. It does remind one somewhat of Mexicans coming into the United States, but the problem, of course, is much more serious because these people have a right to free immigration. I mean, there are, between several of these countries, there are no borders at all. They can just, as you go along the road, you actually can't tell where one country ends and another country begins. So this is Europe's answer to how to maintain, you know, universal peace. If everybody is all part of the same, then how can you have a war? Well, I do appreciate that, but it hasn't really been very salutary in the past 10 years, and I don't think it's going to be in the next either. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we come again to the end of another series in Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Let me take this opportunity of wishing you a very comfortable, relaxed, and nice weekend, and I will be back with you next Tuesday, remembering, please, that we will be having a change of time the following week, Mondays and Thursdays. Okay, but for next week, it's Tuesdays and Fridays. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye for now.